start, the best way to understand the Crusades really is to understand them as a just war. All right? That means a war that is justifiable in fighting. Now here's the common charge made against the church. And I'll address the reason why all of these things become controversial in the first place at the end. But the common charge against the church about the Crusades is simply this. The Crusades were religiously fanatical wars waged by power-hungry popes who wanted to dominate the Holy Land in order to make millions and millions and millions of, the equivalent of millions of dollars for the church. Okay? That's the charge. And that the church has used religion or to fight a war in the name of religion, all right, to justify its acts, and that it is absolutely abhorrent to consider that any Christian would ever engage in a war against another religion. All right? That's a charge. All right? Does anyone want to add to that charge? Anything else you've heard? Because it's a very, very wide sweeping. But that's mostly the gist of it, okay? Okay. So, what about the Crusades? All right, well, let's think back in history a little bit. After the ascent of Christianity in the 4th century, Christianity becomes legal in the year 314 by the Edict of Constantine, the Edict of Nantes, or the Edict of Milan, depending what history you read. Okay? And slowly, Christianity begins to become institutionalized and it spreads around the empire. Now, there's something very, very interesting about Christianity. Constantine does not force people to become Catholic. That's a very important fact. People are not forced to become Catholic. In fact, in large parts of the Roman Empire, polytheism existed side by side with Christianity for actually several hundred years. Right? So it becomes very, very profitable to become a Catholic because the entire government and the entire empire is turning in this way. The popes are being given immense amounts of power and land, right? And kingdom by kingdom is slowly becoming Catholic. Now, by the beginning of the 7th century, the Mediterranean is one big Catholic lake. But notice how Christianity is spread. Missionary activity. Right? It's a very important point. Missionary activity. So, did everyone ever see the movie The Mission? With Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons, remember that? Okay, remember the beginning, right? Where they send two Jesuits into the Amazon and both of them come out dead. Okay, and that's how it would happen. All right? You'd send these missionaries out there and sometimes they'd make it and sometimes they wouldn't. Okay. So the whole Catholic world, the Mediterranean, is one big Catholic lake at the beginning of the 7th century. Now, there's a big problem. Islam. Islam's ascent in the early to the beginning of the 7th century. Islam is not spread by missionary activity. Islam is spread by the sword. Okay? Caliphs and sultans banding together, taking on this slowly coalescing religion, which is really a religious movement, and they begin to invade town after town after town. Forced conversions to Islam. Convert or die. Basically, that's the only way to go. All right? Major, major amounts of persecutions. Okay, now, until the beginning of the 7th century, Catholics had always enjoyed free access to the Holy Land for a very, very important spiritual purpose, pilgrimage. Okay? And it was really, just like Muslims are called today to make at least one pilgrimage to the three cities in Saudi Arabia, right? Mostly Mecca and Medina, and if possible Jerusalem and the Holy Land, because that's the third holiest site in Islam, where any of you been to the Holy Land, you know the Temple Rock, okay, and the Temple Dome. It's where Muhammad is believed to have made his 40 days ascent into the heavens, okay, all right. So, the Catholic Church has always enjoyed access to the Holy Land. Now, picture Europe, right? You're going over the top of Greece, down through what's modern-day Turkey, okay, across the Bosphorus into modern-day Turkey, and then down south into the Holy Land. Okay. When Islam takes over the Holy Land, okay, the Muslims take over, that access is cut off. Now, not only have we lost access, we've also actually lost all the different lands that all belonged to Catholics once upon a time to Islam. Okay? So let's make an example, comparison. Let's say the Canadians invaded us and they took Michigan. Anyone from Michigan? Alright, good. Alright, good. We've got some Michiganers here. Alright, very good. Okay? Now, George, you wouldn't be too happy if Canada took over Michigan. I mean, you know, even though Michigan kind of sticks up there, right? I mean, to its left and its right is Canada, right? Okay? And good parts of Michigan are above the Canadian borderline, right? Okay. So, George is there, you know, with his fellow citizens in Michigan, and they decide, you know what, this ain't right. And they're going to call upon the federal government. Of course, by this time we're bankrupt. Okay? And so, come and bail us out. Take us back. We're one of the 50 states. Don't sell us out like this. Okay. Meanwhile, many Michiganers are subject to O Canada and the Maple Leaf. Okay, into horrible subjection to Canadian culture. Okay, and French. Okay, all right. All these things going on, right? Okay. So you know, we decide. You know, 49 states decide. You know what? We need to go bail our guys out, because, I mean, that's U.S. of A. That's not Canada. Okay. So we go, and we take it, and we take it back. That's a good way of thinking of taking back the Holy Land. It was ours. And you just came in here and took it. All right? Now, was the goal of the Crusades for the Pope to get rich, or actually even for any of the Crusaders to get rich? No. Believe it or not, these men were inspired by religious conviction that fighting for and dying for the cause of retrieving the holiest sites of our religion so that fellow believers could go and have a place to worship. Now, remember, we don't live here in this particular point in history in an age of religious freedom, or some call it religious tolerance. Big difference. Okay? Where, you know, here we are in the United States, right? We sort of live in a country that kind of celebrates almost religious pluralism. You can go down Route 1, many different kinds of expressions of all kinds of faiths, all right? And as long as they're not doing anything illegal, usually religious groups have immense protections under our laws, okay? All right, that's not the way it works in this time of history. If you are a Catholic living in an Islamic country, it is basically the equivalent of treason. Got it? Okay, now, how many of you have worked in the Middle East for the military or for other reasons? Okay, there are still parts of the world where this is very much the case. Did you know you cannot build a church in Saudi Arabia? You can't build a church in Saudi Arabia. You just can't. It's illegal. Okay, and I've had friends who work for the Arab American Oil Company who had to bring in Jesuits and Dominicans week after week under aliases and fake passports so they could go into the compound and say mass. Okay? And that's in Saudi Arabia. And that's now. That wasn't like, you know, 1,000 years ago. That's now. Okay? So that's the world in which we live. So, were there instances during the Crusades of bad behavior? Oh, yes. Very much so. I'll give you two examples. One is a generic problem, and that was the problem of Jewish pogroms. All right? A Jewish pogrom basically meant something like this. You have a band of heavily armed Christian soldiers, right? And they decide that they want to go after certain groups of Jews on their route to the Holy Land, right? Now why? Okay, on one end, many Catholics at the time believed that Jews were Christ killers, right? Another group said, well, remember the Jews are not allowed to own land, right? So the Jews excel in banking using usury. That means taking interest. Okay, this upsets many, many Catholics. Okay? Because the Jewish people dominate this industry. So what's a good way to kind of get a good, you know, swing of retribution to these ne'er-do-well Jews who come into our cities, basically take over our entire banking system, and make more and more money than we ever do while we're working the land as farmers. Okay? Nice little... Okay, so you have a bunch of armed Christian soldiers. Now, it's interesting to note that in almost every instance of a Jewish pogrom, the number one defender of the Jews was the bishop, Catholic bishop of that town. Okay? Now, the bishop would stand out there and tell the soldiers to knock it off, okay, and then to keep on going and not to bother the Jews. Okay? But it's interesting because what does the revisionist history say? No, it's the bishops who actually ordered the killing of the Jews. Not so. There might have been one case, maybe. But the overwhelming majority was Catholic bishops trying to stop. Now, okay, let's just take Bishop Laverde, for example. Okay, how much good is Bishop Laverde going to do without an army standing in front of 300 fully armed men? Not very good. Okay, so the church says, see, the church didn't stop them. Well, sorry, the bishop doesn't have an army. He always relied on civil power, on the civil authorities to conduct, you know, the affairs of justice in the area. Okay. Now, the other big charge against the church, which is what the Greek Orthodox still hold very much against us, in fact, it's really been the reason why we don't have a lot of dialogue with them to this day, is the sack of Constantinople. Okay. A very, very unfortunate moment in history. Alright, so what happened to the sack of Constantinople? This is after the First Crusade, so we're already into the 1100s. A bunch of Italian sailors and soldiers are looking for passage in collusion with some English and Frenchmen who've also shown up to take on the fight to the Holy Land. And they're just south of Venice. And they're looking for passage, shipway over across the Adriatic Sea and then down past Greece to the shores of basically what's now Joppa, just north of Jerusalem. Okay, they're looking for access. All right. So they hire these sort of rogue sailors and mercenaries who are willing to take them for a price. Okay. Well, along the way, they're told by the rogue mercenaries, why don't we make a stop in defenseless Constantinople, and that way you can pay us, okay, before taking you over to the Holy Land, okay? And they said, well, okay, now what's happening in Constantinople? This is the part that's not recorded, my favorite part. 9 months before the sack of Constantinople, right, right, 9 months before the sack of Constantinople, there is a very, very unfortunate incident in the city where the Catholic bishop, okay, is trying to plead, okay, with the Orthodox, all right, to try to find a more peaceful way of trying to negotiate through these very horrid times, especially in dealing with the Muslims, okay? The Orthodox don't like the Catholics very much. The split had occurred in 1052. So the Catholic, the Greek patriarch orders the slaughter of 3,000 Catholic men, women, and children in the main square in Constantinople. Now you never hear about that. So you have a bunch of sailors with this still on their minds, looking for something to pay the people giving them passage, knowing that revenge would be sweet, right? And they go into Constantinople and sack it. Right? Now, was that a very unfortunate incident in Catholic history? Yes. Was it endorsed by the church? No way. In fact, the church never endorsed the killing of innocent civilians. For those of you who are involved in the works of the military, the whole notions of rules of engagement, right, find their roots in Catholic notions of just war. Who are combatants and who are non-combatants? Who you can go after, who you can't go after. Women and children, always, okay? Non-combatants, off limits. Proportional force, okay? Back then, of course, we're talking about gun, you know, bows and arrows and guns here, right? Okay, so nothing too major here. I mean, not even really good guns either, okay? So Was the sack of Constantinople an unfortunate event? Yes. But it's important to remember that never was this actually endorsed by the Pope, by any of the bishops, nor were they sent there to pay back the Orthodox for what they had done 9 months earlier. All right. These are basically individuals taking matters into their own hands, wearing crusader uniform, and then who gets blamed? The church. Okay. So people say, well, you know, the church have had a lot more oversight. Okay. Not possible. Okay, I mean, for example, let's think about our own military, for example, right? I mean, have we not had well-documented court-martial cases throughout U.S. history in wars where soldiers from the United States took matters into their own hands and did not live according to the honor of the uniform? It's true. Okay, but do we then turn around and say, well, you know what, we should just fold up the whole U.S. military? No. Okay, what happens? Those individuals are adjudicated, they're prosecuted, and they're punished. Okay, and hopefully reparations are made. Okay, so the idea here is that it's not, we shouldn't defend what happened, because what happened, what happened in Constantinople is something we should decry. But we should also not take responsibility that the church somehow endorsed it. Much like, for example, the United States government ordered the killing of innocent civilians when it happened by accident, or it happened, you know, with soldiers who were taking matters into their own hands and not following the rules of engagement. I mean, that happens, and it's happened. Okay? Any questions about that so far? Okay. Now, did the Crusaders get rich? No. Most of them died on the way there. The only successful crusade was the first one in 1095. We took back the Holy Land. Only held it for 130 years. After that, the Muslims took over, and we've never had it back since. Okay? Not until the 1940s, with the creation of the Israeli state. Okay? So you can tell all these years passed by. All right, now, it's interesting because Israel is a modern state, and they do allow for religious freedom. Now, it's guarded, okay, for those of you who've been to the Holy Land, and it's kind of a tenuous peace, quote-unquote, okay? But the idea here now is that, you know, in our age, I think we've sort of seen the wisdom of looking at the possibility of different persons of different religious faiths being able to worship in the same space and in the same city. Interestingly enough, one of the bright parts of the Crusades, well, other than the fact that we took back the Holy Land for 130 years in an act of justice, was that one of Suleiman, Caliph Suleiman III's chiefs, came to Jerusalem to pray at the tomb of Christ, which already had been destroyed, by the way, 3 times prior by the Muslims. Okay? Nevertheless, he came to pray. Now, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, the Catholic Patriarch, came out to meet him. And the Caliph says, I want to see where Jesus is supposed to have been raised from the dead. Because we regard him as a prophet. Not God, but regard him as a prophet. I want to see where it happened. Okay. So they go over. And so the Patriarch says, do you want to go in the church? No. I can't. And he said, why not? If I go in the church, my men, when I leave, will destroy your church. Because they will build a mosque on top of it. Okay? So the Patriarch says, so what do you want to do? I'll just pray out here. Where is it? It's right over there. Okay, we'll pray in that direction. He left, the church was left alone, and what did they build right next to it? A mosque. You see the mosque, those of you who have been to the Holy Land, you've seen the mosque right next to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Okay, now, one other thing that I should notice, though, about the Crusades, we should not let the Muslims go and hold them to this as this group of enlightened, wonderfully peace-loving people, okay, who were bothered by Catholic aggression in the 11th century. Okay, because if you watch certain movies, it's the Catholics who are the awful, power-hungry, money-grabbing, greedy, unprincipled, you know, hooligans. And the Muslims are this very advanced culture, this very peace-loving, baloney. Okay, that's just baloney. Okay? I mean, there has never been a faith more aggressive about promoting itself through violence than Islam. That's a fact. Okay, and if you have any questions about that, we can talk about that afterwards. You can ask my friend Daniel Ali, who's a convert to Catholicism from Islam. There's still a bounty on his head. Okay, now, next one. Inquisition, 12 and 1300. So we're forced fast-forwarding here about 100 years. Now, the Inquisition. I would say that the Inquisition probably is the single darkest moment in Catholic history. But it's not as bad as people make it out to be. Okay, how does an Inquisition work? All right, what is an Inquisition? Okay, an Inquisition is a tribunal, it's a court set up to investigate whether or not a certain individual charged is in fact a heretic, meaning a non-believer. All right, now, again, this may offend every American sensibility you may have about religious pluralism, okay? You can't think of these things merely in terms of our own sensibilities and terms. Remember, we're dealing with 13th and 12th century thought, okay? If you're evaluating any of these things, by the way, by current standards, you say, oh, horrible. How could this ever have been the case? Okay, now, you know, I like to remind people, especially Americans who, you know, jump on this bandwagon, don't forget, we had slavery in this country. Women couldn't vote or own property, and the unborn are still have no legal protection. So don't go start telling me about civil rights and, you know, being humane. We've killed more people in the abortion holocaust, nearly 50 million since 1973 in this country, than all past wars combined. Okay, so, you know, before people get on their high horse about how humane we are, please, okay, I choke. All right. So, this is what happens. Let's just take an example. The Spanish Inquisition is a good one. Let's say Kurt is a Catholic, right? But he's decided for economic gain that he is going to... No, better yet. Kurt, I'll give you a better example. You are a Catholic, okay? But for economic gain, you're going to start colluding with Jews, okay? Because of banking interests. You don't think usury is that big of a deal, right? And you see how much money is available to you because you might apostatize. That means deny Christianity. Okay, now, you have to understand, if you do that, and remember the church and the state are like this, okay? If you do that, that's an act of treachery against the crown. Because the crown is a defender of the faith in Spain. Okay? They defend the faith. All right. Nevertheless, you think that it's worth the risk. Okay, so now, let's see here. Bob and Ines are your neighbors, okay? Literally, all right? They're your neighbors. And they suspect something's fishy, right? They don't see you at church. They've seen you gone to a couple of Seder meals over the last couple of years. You know, you're not wearing anything outwardly that would give you away. But they're beginning to wonder or not. They haven't seen you pray the rosary with the family. Okay, you always miss the holy days. Where is Kurt these days, okay? So Bob and Inez accuse you of apostasy, leaving the Catholic faith, or in this particular case, you're leaving it. Okay, you're denying Christ. Okay. Now, maybe your motivations aren't really purely religious. It's for economic gain. Nevertheless, you know that one of the conditions for this economic bonus is you have to be, you know, deny Christ and become a Jew. Okay. Not to mention circumcision. Okay. So Kurt's like, not sure about this now at all. Okay. It's not worth it. Okay. Now, what happens is Bob and Ines can accuse you, okay, of this apostasy. And so you are arrested, and the charges are brought before you. Now, this is one aspect of the justice that we would never understand. Bob and Ines you don't get to confront your accuser. Okay? The accusations are made, and then there's a trial brought up, okay, to investigate, in fact, whether you are or not. Now, this is what the court is thinking. What you've done, Kurt, is very, very bad. It's mortally sinful, and it's worthy of eternal damnation. If we can get you to change, okay, to return back to the faith, right, to convert back to Catholicism, better you deal with us in this life than what will surely await you in the next. Big difference between now and then? Now, no one believes in hell. Back then, everyone did. Okay? So it's the devil you know, the devil you don't know. Now, this is very interesting. Many times, in fact, what would happen with these cases is that the person who would arrest you is not the church. It'd be the Spanish crown. Okay? And the Spanish crown would put you on the rack or do waterboarding or something. Okay? All right? That's what they would do. Now, the state's interest in you is not religious, per se. Their interest in you is not to be a traitor. You're an infiltrator into, you know, the Catholic world. Okay? So, many times, all right, what many people who were accused of heresy would do, or apostasy in your case would do, right? Or let's just say they were accused of treachery or treason, they would actually go to the civil court and they would purposefully blaspheme God's name, because once that happened, you could no longer be tried by a civil court who is very ready to chop your head off or to torture you, okay? You would be tried suddenly by a church court. In almost every single case of where the crown wanted to kill you, who is the chief group of persons trying to plead on your behalf? The church. Why? The church doesn't want exact capital punishment on you. We want to convert you and reform you because you're redeemable. Okay, saying that you're beyond redemption is sort of negating the power of the cross. Okay, you get where I'm going with this? Okay, now, is this a world that any of us are familiar with? Absolutely not. I mean, we think this is sort of absolutely horrible that people be persecuted by the religious beliefs. After all, were not many of the people who came to this country as colonists fleeing religious persecution? Many of them were fleeing inquisitions. And the Inquisition, by the way, was not merely a Catholic phenomenon. Inquisitions occurred in Northern Europe with the Protestants. In Germany, had actually one of the biggest ones. The two most infamous ones are the Roman Inquisition and the Spanish Inquisition. Why? Okay? Because, well, lots of operas and plays and books were written on the abuses committed by certain clerics in regards to the Inquisition. Now, here's where the abuse can occur. If I'm the cleric questioning you, right? My uncle happens to also be the governor. Right? See where these conflicts of interest arise? Lots of different abuses occur through that. Now here's the problem. It's said that the Inquisition, by revisionist historians, claimed 10 million lives. Okay, not true. There were not enough people accused to be able to be killed to amass to 10 million victims. Okay, more along the lines, 10 to 25,000, depending what history you read. Now, is it deplorable that the church got colluded with the state in some of these conflict of interest cases? Sure. Absolutely. Why I say it's probably one of the darkest moments in church history. Okay? Any question about that? Okay. All right. That's good. Okay, now I want to say a couple more things about the Inquisition, because it's kind of unfortunate how this all kind of came together. Ferdinand and Isabel, in my opinion, was probably the greatest Catholic monarch ever, was responsible for the purging of the Jews out of Spain in the 15th century. Now, this also becomes fodder for anti-Catholic rhetoric in the media. So you see, the church at her heart is anti-Semitic. Okay. Before I get to that, let me just read this here. Between 1540 and 1700 in Spain, between 1540 and 1700 in Spain, so a period of about 160 years here, in Spain there were 828 persons executed. That means one out of eight. 90% of the accused were never tortured. Okay? In the entire Spanish Empire, between 1560 and 1614, only 2% of the cases brought before the Inquisition resulted in execution. Interesting, because Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, and the English Tudors all used torture and capital punishment to punish heretics. Okay? In fact, Calvin himself, during his rule for 20 years in Geneva, Switzerland, had 58 executed for serious sins, 900 imprisoned, and 73 exiled. Now, you might ask yourself, what's at work here? Why is this such an important thing for the spirit of history? Well, Ferdinand and Isabel decided on the expulsion of the Jews from the Iberian Peninsula during their reign, okay, 15th century. All right, now, why? All right, remember, Kurt, if you're not a Catholic, you are a clear and present danger to the security and sovereignty of the state. Now, who's to the south across the Straits of Gibraltar? The Moors. Okay? They're Muslims. You have Jews everywhere. All right? And the Jews, I mean, are really probably the most resilient people of all time. I mean, you know, you exile them out of somewhere, they end up somewhere else, and then they prosper wherever they go. Okay? I mean, incredibly bright people. If you think about just sort of per capita, okay? Now, the problem we're having here, okay, is that at this particular time in history, you have the formation, all right, of all of these different kingdoms. Anyone in the kingdom who is not a Christian is not welcome, okay? So if you have Jews infiltrating your banking system, for example, just to use one example, you're not sure who they're with. They're quite as easy to collude with the Muslims, they're quite as easily to collude with your enemies, and they have lots of money. Better get rid of them. Now, we think of this as terrible, right? But we had sort of an expulsion of this, didn't we, with the Native Americans in our country? Right? Running them onto reservations? I mean, Japanese internment camps? I mean, we had things like this in this country, right? Okay, and we're a much younger country, by the way. Okay, this is occurring maybe 800 years ago. Okay, 600 years ago. But in our country, we had fairly similar things going on, not because of religion, but because of land grabbing. Okay, they were on the land, we wanted the land, we can't both have it, okay, and we can't endure any more tax, so rent them up, ship them out, okay? Or every Japanese person was considered a threat in this country, right? I know many of my former parishioners who are old enough to have lived during World War II, if they were of German or Italian descent, never let anyone know. And they never spoke German or Italian in school or on the street during the Second World War. Why? You were suspected of being a colluder with the enemy. Anyone remember that era? Okay, some of you are old enough to remember that. Okay, I mean, I know most of you aren't, but some of you are old enough. Those who are like smiling. Okay. Okay, let's move on past the Inquisition. Now, Galileo. This is a great one. All right, now here's a charge. Let me go back up to the Inquisition before I leave that. You know, the charge, by the way, I didn't do this properly. The charge made against the church against the Inquisition is that the church basically killed thousands of people because they didn't tolerate religious freedom or religious tolerance. And how on earth could a church possibly stand by thousands died simply because of their faith? Okay, it wasn't simply because of their faith. It was because, remember, not being of the same religion was basically a form of treason. Okay? All right, so again, it's very, very easy to sort of justify or to gloss over the lenses by which people were making their decisions back then using modern sensibilities about religious freedom, religious tolerance. Now, it's interesting though, you know, I know we've come a long way, I would say, in history, but we also haven't come a long way. Right? Like, remember after, had anyone ever been to any concentration camps? Right? Okay, in most of the concentration camps, they have memorials, you know, memorializing the dead, the memory of the dead. One of the concentration camps I've been to is in Dachau, which is outside of Munich. I went to go visit there because that's where most priests who were killed during the Second World War were kept, in barrack number 14. There were nearly 3,000 priests who lived there during the war who were killed. That's a lot of priests, 3,000 priests. Okay, that's more priests than the entire United States. Okay, so one of the big memorials outside of Dachau, right outside of the barracks, is this very big sort of artistic monstrosity, but it says in maybe 8 different languages, never again. Okay? Bosnia, Rwanda, Darfur, never again. Right? Okay, so it's interesting because we have come a long way in the grand scheme of things, right? But in also in other ways, we've also regressed a lot. And we've gone back to where we said we were never going to go. Or like in China. I mean, how many Chinese babies are aborted every day? You can only have one. You think 1 billion people are not having babies? Are not conceiving children? I mean, you know what I mean? Okay, I mean, it's going on every minute of the day. You know, granted, it's silent, and it's kind of, you know, not heard of. You don't get a lot of reporting on it. I mean, who really hears about that going on? Or, has anyone ever been to Haiti? Haiti as a whole. I mean, Haiti is super dangerous. I mean, it's absolutely crazy down there. You know, I mean, it's a basically vigilante justice. And this is in our hemisphere, less than 3 hours by plane from Florida. And I have some brother priests assigned on the Dominican Republic border of Haiti, on the western side of the DR, the eastern side of Haiti, the island of Hispaniola. And, oh my gosh, I mean, and I have friends who are Haitians, and the stories they can tell, I mean, just to this day, you know, it's unbelievable. So, it's interesting how, you know, the modern man does seem to think that we're morally superior in a certain way. But when you look at a lot of more very recent examples, I could make a very strong argument that we're not. We just found different ways to be barbaric. You know, it's just more covert. Okay, all right. So, again, I just don't like it when people just immediately poo-poo the mores of the times, citing them as being backwards and whatever, you know, okay. Now, let's talk about Galileo. Galileo lived from 1564 to 1642. He's a Catholic, okay? An Italian, no surprise there, with a name like Galileo Galilei. Now here's the charge. Galileo supported this theory that was purported by a guy named Copernicus. It's called the heliocentric theory of the universe. Okay, what it means is that just our solar system revolves around the sun. Now, at the time, conventional thought was that we had what's called a geocentric theory. Everything revolved around the earth. Okay, now, why would that even be important? All right. Well, because the basis for the geocentric theory was biblical. It seems from Genesis that God created the earth and everything in it as the apex of his whole creation of the universe. And as such, the whole world revolves around us. The whole universe revolves around us. Get it? Okay. Now, Copernicus had a theory, Nicholas Copernicus had a theory, about 100 years before Galileo, that this was not in fact the case. Now, the interesting thing was that the charge that's given to the church is that the church is anti-science, the church is anti-scientific progress, and the church is anti-academic freedom. Okay? Therefore, they shut down Galileo, because he was purporting a theory that contradicted what many thought the Bible said. Okay? Alright. Now, should be noted, the geocentric theory has always been held as a theory in the Catholic Church. Was never defined as doctrine. Okay? It was a theory. Now why? Every single pope said the same thing. We are not scientists, and the Bible is not in the business of telling us how the world works, but how the world rather came to be. Okay? Big difference, right? Okay. And the popes are very smart. They said it's not really in our, this is not our competence. Now, interestingly enough, Galileo received all of his grants, what are grants, benefices at the time, from the church. In fact, in many cases, directly from the Pope himself. All right, the Pope would pay Galileo to do his studies and to you know, sit out there in the stars and to do his measurements and all these things. Okay. Now, the church did not put Galileo under torture. That's a charge made. Galileo was never tortured. He was put under house arrest. He never spent a day in jail. Now, why did this happen? What was all the facts leading up to it? Okay. The issue at hand was not geocentric or heliocentric. The Pope had no... It didn't matter to him. In fact, privately, it's been discovered lately in this Pope's private writings that he actually favored a heliocentric theory. What Galileo was saying. Okay? What happened was simply this. Galileo did not like the fact that many of his inquisitors thought that he was a heretic. Okay? And Galileo was a brilliant debater and orator. So what would happen is, what Galileo decided to do was this. In order to make his case without explicitly talking about the heliocentric theory, he wrote a book. And in the book is a dialogue between a very erudite scientist, who is Galileo, but not, it's a pseudonym, and a buffoon, who's the Pope. Okay? And he shows the buffoon, which the irony, of course, is that the buffoon, the Pope, actually supported Galileo's research. He was paying for the research and actually thought Galileo was right. Okay, but that wasn't enough for Galileo. He had to make a statement that the church needed to get out of his way. Okay? So he writes this book where he pits himself as this erudite scientist, philosopher, against the Pope, who's this buffoon. Okay? The book is released. Everyone in Christendom knows what this is all about. Okay? So the Pope cannot let this go unchecked, because it's a scandal. If any Tom, Dick, and Harry can decide to call the Pope a buffoon, and he's a spiritual father of the entire known world, okay, you can't let that go. So what does he do? He imprisons Galileo in his house, takes all his money away, and says, you're not doing any more research. Not because I disagree with your science, but because you're an arrogant SOB. That's my problem with you. Now, what does revisionist history say? No, the Pope imprisoned him and tortured him because the Pope didn't want the heliocentric theory to be released. Not at all. In fact, it's very clear now, if you even read Galileo's Daughter, which is this popular book written on this whole affair, at the end, the author does concede that the Holy Father actually was very sympathetic to what Galileo, and you know, and the Pope, by the way, himself was a scientist, you know, and had an interest in these questions. But the issue was never about the science. The issue was about how Galileo went about his business. Okay? So, the very man who was actually supporting his work gets depicted in a book written by Galileo as a buffoon. And that leads to Galileo's house arrest for most of the rest of his life. Okay. Now, it's interesting because many people credit Galileo with inventing the telescope. He did not invent the telescope. Okay? Somebody else did. I don't know who it was. Probably some Chinese guy. Okay. Now, What else? All right. 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 The Pope's problem with Galileo, and his name was Pope Urban VIII, if you want to look it up. Okay? All right. Yeah, it's fine. Pope Urban VIII was actually part of Galileo's scientific society and a great fan. Okay. Now, last one, Pius XII. Right, before I do that, let's make sure there's any latecomers. Abby? Gail? Abigail? Did David Couch show up? No. Amy Kovats? No. Jordan Melvin? Marie Parizzi or Morgan Parizzi? Okay. I'm guessing you're Marie. Okay. Okay. Great. Okay. Now, Pius XII, my favorite one. Okay. What's the charge? Pius XII's silence led to the slaughter of 6 million Jews. Heard this one before? You should have. I mean, you watch TV. Not that I recommend it, but if you watch TV, okay, there's really nothing good on. You know, I gave up TV for Lent. Not that I watch a lot of TV, but, you know, I just realized there's really nothing good on. Anyway, okay. So let's talk about Pius XII for a second, 1940s. Now, let's kind of back up here for a second, okay, and understand Pius XII a little bit. Pius XII, before becoming Pius XII, Eugenio Pacelli, was the Secretary of State of the Vatican, and before that, the Ambassador of the Holy See to Germany. Okay? He loved Germany. Spoke fluent German. Right? Which, if you know any Italians, is hard to do. Okay? It's a very different language, German and Italian. Very different. Okay. Sorry, this is dinner. Okay. So, Pius XII, the Secretary of State, and before that, he's the Ambassador of the Holy See, the Nuncio of the Holy See, to Germany. All right. Galileo knows the guys. I mean, Galileo. Pius XII. Oh my gosh. Pius XII knows the guys in the Third Reich. He knows them. He knew them before they rose to power. He knew them when they rose to power. And he knew them probably after they rose to power. Okay? Now, here's the controversy, or supposed controversy. Pius XII refused to speak out against Nazism during the ascent of the Third Reich in 1939 as it began to mow down most of what's Eastern Europe and take it country after country. Okay, now, nothing could be farther from the truth. All right? In fact, believe it or not, the day after Christmas in 1943, the New York Times lauded Pius XII as the only voice of reason and virtue on a very dark European continent, hiding under the shadow of war in 1943. Golda Meir, one of the early prime ministers of Israel, had 1,000 plants planted in Jerusalem, 1,000 olive trees planted in Jerusalem, and declared Pius XII a righteous Jew, a righteous Gentile, for his efforts to save the Jews. Now, what happened? This attack on Pius XII was nothing he ever knew in his lifetime. He was he was Time Life's Man of the Year in 1944, on the cover. Now, I know we think of Time Life as being sort of a recent thing. They had Man of the Year back then, Pius XII. Okay? Now, what was he actually doing? Pius XII was using every single pontifical facility in the city of Rome to hide, sequester, or help Jews escape from Italy into Vatican City State and to any of the properties the Holy See owns in the city of Rome. You see, the Vatican is a city-state which is totally within Rome. But the Holy See owns tons of property all over Italy. And each of those pieces of property are as if you were in the Vatican Embassy. Each of those pieces of property have sovereignty. And the Holy Father, Pope Pius XII, would use church position to save Jews, make fake IDs and passports, and smuggle Jews to various parts of Europe to get them out of harm's way. Now, Pius XII never knew the criticism he received, he's received now. It'd be totally foreign to him. In fact, isn't it interesting that after World War II, the chief rabbi of Rome became a Catholic? Think about that. The chief rabbi of Rome after World War II, okay, he was the chief rabbi of Rome during World War II, but after World War II, he became a Catholic. What did he take as his confirmation name? Eugenio, Eugene, after Eugenio Pacelli, his great friend with whom he collaborated to save thousands of his fellow Jews. So what happened? Okay, the year 1968, a German playwright by the name of Ralph Hochhuth writes a play called The Deputy. Okay? And The Deputy is a parody of the Holy Father, Pius XII, during World War II. And it describes him as a collaborator with the Germans. After all, he was ambassador to Germany from the Holy See in the late 1930s. And he sold out the identities of thousands of Jews during World War II to protect priests and Catholics. All right? Nothing could be farther from the truth. I mean, the historical record is preposterously opposed to any accusation made against Pius XII. In fact, all of his peers in the Jewish community praised him for what he had done. Even the chief rabbi of Rome becoming a Catholic and taking his name as his confirmation saint makes you wonder, right? Now, have we had a similar event in our own time? Yes, the Da Vinci Code. See, everyone wrote off the Deputy as entertainment. As many people have written off the Da Vinci Code as entertainment. Okay? But the Da Vinci Code's blasphemous. It pits Jesus having a wife in the person of Mary Magdalene. He had children. Right? It puts members of our church in Opus Dei in a very negative light, which is, of course, totally unfounded. Okay? I mean, if they have, what's his name? Silas the albino monk, right, who's a member of Opus Dei. First of all, Opus Dei is not a religious order. There are no monastics, and only 0.5% of their members are priests. Okay? And I asked my Opus Dei friends if there's an albino monk named Silas in any of their residences. And they always joke, yeah, they actually keep a dinner place for him, a table, you know, in case Silas shows up for dinner. Okay? So, all of these different things that have been said about the church are kind of really aimed at one very simple idea. You might wonder to yourself, why are all these different things brought up? I mean, do you see these things brought up against Protestant churches? Never. Jewish people? Never. Muslims? Not really. Okay? So why? Why the church? Well, it's very simple. In the West, the media knows that the last credible source of moral authority in the world is the Catholic Church. It's the last credible source of moral authority. You know, people don't go to consult, with all due respect, to the Dalai Lama or Desmond Tutu about how to handle world affairs. But you better well believe that the Vatican is called in to consult at the United Nations or in the State Department as to whether or not the President of the United States should launch a war in Iraq. You don't think the Holy See was involved in those talks about whether or not the war was just? Interesting. Three cardinals from Rome spent a very inordinate amount of time at the State Department 1 month before he went to Iraq. I wonder what they were doing there. Giving spiritual direction? Hearing confessions? Saying mass? I don't think so. Okay? So the media knows, and the secularists know, because they want to divorce God from the public discourse. They know one simple fact. If you can supplant the Catholic Church, because it's the last moral authority on earth, you You can always replace it with yourself. And isn't it in fact the case? What makes morality in our country today? Opinion polls, not objective truth. Right? If so many percent of Americans say we should do it, well, therefore we should do it. Right? Not whether or not it's maybe good or true or right or maybe what a God-fearing people might want or not do. Okay. So the media doesn't have it, but it has its own brand of religion. Okay. It's a very secular brand where, what's religion? You who are becoming Catholic, please do not express it openly, the media says. Your religion should be a private affair, which you just do in the privacy of your own, but to bring it outside and to make it active and alive and to evangelize, please don't do that. That's what the media said. I mean, that's the code. Okay? So, it's interesting because I guarantee you, right, we're the only church left who actually has to answer these questions. I mean, it's kind of, in a way, it's a compliment that we have to answer these questions, not because of dark episodes in our past, but because of the fact that the church is still considered so... I mean, if we were not a moral authority, do you think people would even care about this stuff? No. Not at all. But because we are, people have decided that they want to come after us. Now, I don't mean to say this to have sort of like a martyr complex or this whole conspiracy theory. I don't. I mean, I relish in the fact that we're attacked insofar as it's showing that we're still doing our job. Right? This is my last class with you all. Okay, so I'm not going to be with you the rest of the way. So the rest of the way, you guys are with the pastor, Father DiMartino. But I've enjoyed teaching you immensely. I hope you've gotten something out of our time together. And especially for those of you who are new to the faith, congratulations and welcome. I would just say this. Finishing RCIA is just the beginning. It is not the end. Okay, and it's certainly not graduation from adult education in the faith. It's just the beginning. I admire all of you who are becoming Catholic, especially our brothers and sisters who are not Catholic yet. I mean, the cradle Catholics are being confirmed. You have my admiration in a qualified sense. But those of you who are becoming Catholic from other religious expressions really have my admiration because just this is good evidence, what I just presented you tonight. You're walking into the snare. I mean, you're walking into the Fowler's trap because this is what you're taking on as your faith is constantly under attack. And if you look in the media today, I mean, they've done studies of this at Georgetown at the Pew Center for Research. The last acceptable bias in the media is against Catholics. And here you are becoming Catholics. You know, so I think it's very and almost heroic in this day and age to become a Catholic. Especially if you're going to really live the faith, you know, and live it out. Because you're really kind of inviting, it's like you're putting a target on your back. Okay? So I invite you to be zealous in your faith, and also I know that, you know, many of the things we talked about are somewhat confusing and difficult to understand. I understand that. I myself am constantly still studying to figure these things out myself. But they're wonderful mysteries to behold because they're God's revelation to us. Again, if you guys do want to seek us out, either of us or both of us, to talk about some of these questions you've had or whatever, there are two kinds of questions you may have. One set of questions are just sort of curiosities or clarifications, but essentially you are convinced the faith is the one true faith and that you want to become a Catholic. Okay. And by the way, it's not just a matter of where you put your money in the collection basket on Sunday or where you park your car and walk into a building. It's entering a life. The second kind of question, though, is more serious, and that is questions essentially about the doctrine of the faith. Right? When you step forward on Easter Vigil on April 11 in the evening, one of the things that you're going to make is a profession of faith. For many of you, the statements you're going to make are fairly simple because they're things you already believe and have always believed from your childhood. But the last line of the profession of faith is, I believe everything that the Catholic Church teaches and proposes as worthy of belief. And St. Paul reminds us, right, let your yes be yes and your no mean no. Right? So if you have questions about that and what that means or what you're signing yourself up for, you know, time's running out. Okay, before April 11. It's right around the corner. So do make sure you do seek us out to seek to get those things clarified or to work them out in your minds, because I think that if they're not, that's always going to be fodder for the devil to tempt you to doubt your faith and to leave it. Unfortunately, there is a highly significant rate of attrition of converts to the Catholic faith from Protestantism. They go for a while, but then after 5 years, they fade away. And they go back to their old religion. Okay? So, you know, part of it is because there's a lot of doubt in their mind about the doctrine of the faith and whether or not they can accept it. So this is something that you're really struggling with. Please do not, I mean, this is as good a time as any to have these things answered. The other thing, too, I just want to note, make mention before I let you guys go is there's a box going around. I don't know, it's a Joan box. Oh, there it is. The Joan box is right here. Father and I are considering teaching a summer course just on random topics. If there are any topics that you'd like taught, you can write them in here and leave them in here for us so that we can present them this summer. And it's not going to be like an organized class insofar as like we have like a syllabus. We'll have a schedule and what the topic is for the night. But it's not going to be like, you know, here how we went through all the commandments in a row or different parts of the creed in a row. It's not going to be organic like that. It'll just be sort of random. But we want to keep on teaching because we're told by many of you that there's a desire to keep on learning. And there's lots that we can... And Father DiMartino is a very, very gifted priest in terms of spiritual theology. I hope you guys put lots of suggestions for that because I'll come to those classes. Okay? All right, let's pray. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Together, glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Okay, we'll see you next week. For those of you who thought that you had it off, next week is just an open session, and you didn't hear this, Father DiMartino.